Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Connerly, and if we had a master of ceremonies, he or she would be standing up saying wonderful things about me, and I know that for sure because I would have written my introduction myself. We have no MC, so here I am. I'm Bill Connerly, the economist who connects the dots between business, between economics and business, and we're going to do an hour and 15 minutes worth of economics. And I want to tell you, we've been learning economics lessons in the Connerly family, and I thought I'd share with you some of the lessons we've gone through. The first lesson goes back 5 years ago when I was finishing up a meeting with one of my consulting clients, and he said, Bill, I've got one last question for you, but it's not really economics. He said, I know you push numbers around on spreadsheets a lot. Can you help me with an Excel problem? And I said, sure. And he said, I need to create 6 charts for each of the 50 states. Is there a way to automate that so I don't have to go click, click, click 300 times? And I said, oh, I think you could do that with a visual basic macro. And he gets excited. This was obviously kind of weighing on him. And then I had to admit, I don't know how to do visual basic macros. I just know it's out there. And he gets kind of glum, and I really understood it was important. And just with, I blurted out. You ever do this? You blurt out without thinking. Oh, my son knows everything there is to know about visual basic. And the guy gets excited. And he's thinking that maybe he can get in touch with my son. At this point, I have to explain to him that my son, at the time, was 15 years old and completely self-taught. He says, I think that's what I need. My corporate IT department has been useless. I think I need a teenager. So I put the two of them together. They struck a deal, $10 an hour. And 7 hours, $70 later, this guy has a program that will automate the production of charts. They're using it to this day. And I thought it was pretty cool, and this is a learning opportunity. You know, you're a parent, you have to take the learning opportunity. So I said, Tom, this is an example of the economics of networking. You didn't know the client didn't know you, but you're both better off because you had done some networking. And he thanked me. Actually, he rolled his eyes, but I like to think of that as a teenager's way of thanking somebody for a parent for trying to be a good parent. Well, the next lesson happened a couple of years later. That same client contacted my son independently with another project. And then my son comes to me a couple of days later and said, hey, Daddy, I need some business advice. I quoted the guy $100 for this project, thinking it was about 10 hours. But once I got into it, I found a little trick. And it only took me 3 hours to finish the project. Should I stick with the $100 I quoted him? And I said, Tom, it is time you learned about value pricing. It is not worth based on what it costs you to produce it. It's worth what the customer thinks it's worth. This time he really did thank me. So that was our second lesson. The third lesson happened 2 years ago. And I was doing some work for on a different consulting project. And I downloaded data from a government website, do it all the time, only this time it was 20,000 rows in an Excel spreadsheet. It was messy. I needed to get them ready to go into my econometric software package. And I knew that my son was really busy with schoolwork, so I'm thinking I've got to find a freelance programmer. Maybe $1,000, $600 if I'm lucky. And I happened to mention it to him one evening, and he said, well, Daddy, email me the file. Let me just take a look at it. So at 10 p.m., just before I went to sleep, I emailed him the file. The next morning, I got up, fired up the computer. There's a reply from my son with an attachment. I double-clicked the attachment, and my data perfectly formatted exactly the way I wanted it. I'm so happy. Then I look at the timestamp on his email, 11:15 p.m., it had taken him an hour and 15 minutes to solve my problem. And then I got around to the body of the message, which was, hey, Daddy, take a look at this file. If it's what you want, how about $150? $150, my own son taking advantage of me. And I don't know where he gets it. I was getting a little steamed when my wife pulled me aside and said, Bill, that's a very good value. So even we economists have some ways to learn a little bit about economics. What I'm going to do this afternoon is talk about what's happening in the economy, what are the problems of the economy, how we're going to get through those problems, and what my forecast is. And along the way, I am going to offer some content clues. So if you're thinking, gee, what do I want to do with my meetings in this environment? I think there are some topics that make more sense in 2009 than they ever did before, and I'll give you those suggestions along the way. Now let's talk about what's going on here. We're in a recession. This is job growth. You know we're in a recession unless you've just really been out of touch. Now, there are some things I don't understand. Like, this is the third week of President Obama's administration, and we're still in recession? You know, what's up with that? But we're in recession because of three major problems, and we're going to go through those. And as we talk about the problems, I'll explain how we get out of them. The first problem is too much housing. And what this chart shows is vacancy rates. The upper one for rental units, like apartments, but also houses for rent. The lower line shows the vacancy rate for non-rental units. The government calls this owner-occupied housing, only this is owner-unoccupied housing. And let's look at that first. Two-thirds of the housing units in America are in this bottom line, normally 1.5%, maybe 2% vacancy that are just sort of waiting for a new owner to come in. We're now at 3% vacancy. So too many housing units, and that's the housing problem we all understand. Look at the upper line, though. This is rental. This is a third of all housing units. We've got a higher than normal vacancy rate for apartments and other rentals. So it's not just one sector. It's all over. Let me tell you about a dream I had a few weeks ago. I dreamt I was sailing my boat. That's a pretty common dream. And through a navigational error, I ended up on this remote South Pacific island, sort of tropical paradise island. Now, there are parts of this dreams I cannot share with you, but the part I can was when the islanders found that I was an economist, they wanted some help. They said, hey, help us because the market for grass-roofed houses, they all live in little huts, grass huts, the market for grass huts was lousy. And they were thinking maybe they should have a grass hut mortgage housing administration, or they should regulate the lenders. The guys lend clams for the purchase of grass huts. Maybe a lower interest rate for grass hut mortgages. They weren't quite sure what to do. But as I visited their community, I counted 100 families, 110 grass huts. Now think about that. 100 families, 110 grass huts. What kind of financial engineering solves that? What's the interest rate that helps the grass hut market? What kind of mortgage mechanism do you need when you have 100 families, 110 grass huts? There's nothing. There's nothing you can do in a financial engineering sense to solve that problem. You simply have too many grass huts. So I recommended that they have a fire. Now, bringing this actually to the United States, we don't use fire to get rid of excess housing units except in the city of Detroit. The way in which, there's probably somebody from Detroit here. Well, if you are from Detroit, let me just assure you, I'll insult everybody by the time we're done. So what are we going to do to deal with the excess supply of houses? We're going to grow our country. We grow our population by about 1% a year. That's 3 million people, 1.4 million households. Give us some time, and we are going to solve this problem. But it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's not going to happen quickly. And the suggestions that you may hear politicians say, 4% interest rates. You know, if we get low interest rates, more subprime lending, what are we doing here? We can help the bottom part of the market, but it's at the expense of the rental market, because we're not going to pull people out of cardboard boxes and put them into housing through low interest rates. We're just going to shift from one to the other. So we're going to have this problem, and it's going to last quite a while until we just grow, and I think we have another year. So this is part of the housing problem, part of the broader economic problem, and it's going to continue. Now, we manifest this in housing starts, and it's going down. But one of the things that's worth pointing out here, a little lesson, is that this has not gone to zero. Now, we have more housing than is normal in both rental and single-family housing units, and yet the builders are still building new houses. Are they like crazy? Well, they're real estate developers. They are kind of crazy. But one of my clients, I'm from Portland, Oregon. One of my clients is a builder of new homes, the largest home builder, and he is continuing to build new homes, even though the second largest builder is bankrupt. The third largest builder is bankrupt. We have excess homes sitting empty in many parts of the community. And yet this guy, the number one builder, continuing to build homes. So I said to him, Larry, what the heck are you doing? And man, he said something that I would have expected to hear from like Fritz Hayek, the Nobel laureate. He said, people are not buying a generic home. People are buying a specific type of home with specific features in a specific neighborhood at a specific price point. And we have found a few areas where there isn't an oversaturation of those specific kinds of properties, and that's what we're building. And it's worth mentioning because you'll hear generalizations about our society, our economy. Oh, everybody is tapped out. Well, never. Never is everybody tapped out. We may have a lot of people tapped out. We have more people tapped out than last year, but we're not going to have everybody tapped out. So there are some niches. So that's the first problem. What does that mean if you're thinking about planning a program? Here are some clues. This is an important subject if you're running a meeting for people in the construction industry or in the whole construction supply chain. So that's wood products, door and window manufacturers, even title insurance, mortgage originators. But most business leaders, government leaders, nonprofit leaders do not have actionable steps. And when I'm thinking about how do I talk to people in a meeting, one of the things in the back of my mind all the time is how can I help them make a decision Monday morning after the meeting is over? And people want to talk about the housing crisis. It's important to them. It's a big topic of cocktail party chatter. But it is not an actionable item for people except for those listed. So my recommendation, heck, you can do whatever you want, but my recommendation is if you're planning a meeting for sort of a general audience of leaders, whether it's business, government, or nonprofits, mention this only in briefly in passing. It's interesting to them. Your committee may talk about it, but because it's not actionable, give it a short shrift. Now, if the only thing we had going on in our economy was this housing crisis, we would not have a recession. The housing construction industry is not big enough to give us an overall recession, but you can get a recession if you add on a couple of problems. So let's add on a problem. We've got a credit crunch. And this is a picture of credit, new credit extended in 2007. 2008 data is not complete. And besides, 2008 really wasn't a normal year, in case you haven't figured that out. So 2007, the important thing here is to notice just how big and important business credit is. A lot of people talk about consumer credit, and they think that's important to the health of the economy because consumer spending is two-thirds of the economy. But consumer credit isn't nearly as important as business credit. Now, why is that? A company in operation spends money before it gets paid. So a company has to pay employees, has to pay rent, may have to buy raw materials or pay other vendors, and they do all that before they themselves get paid by their customers. So credit is a lubricant. I can imagine an economy with relatively little credit. On the consumer side, people would save. Have you guys heard that word, save? You know, most Americans haven't. It's where you don't spend all your money. I can imagine consumers saving. I can imagine businesses having more capital and less borrowing. But the sudden transition from an economy with a lot of credit to an economy without much credit, that is harsh. That means that suddenly things stop. And we had the best example of it, I think, in human history in 1997 with the Asian financial crisis. We had companies in Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines that were profitable. They were used to borrowing money, but suddenly their banks could no longer serve them. And here's a profitable company. It just needs to buy new raw materials, and it can sell them at a profit, and they cannot get access to credit. And the reason they couldn't is sort of what was going on in the international banking world. I'd love to tell you if you're interested, but let's just leave it at this, that their banking system broke down. And that lack of credit caused a short but very sharp downturn in those countries, lasting just under 2 years. So that's what I worry about. When we started to see stress in the financial markets, it is my concern that we will lose that lubricant. Now, in terms, a lot of the discussion in the op-ed sections is about merit, who deserves a bailout, who deserves to get spanked, and I've got my opinions on that too. But thinking about the forecast, thinking about the outlook, I'm more concerned with what keeps business going. And I think it's very important that we keep business credit going. So what happened to business credit? Let's take a look. The first thing I want to talk about is bank attitudes about credit. The Federal Reserve does a survey of bank lenders every quarter and asks them, gee, are you tightening your credit standards? And in this case, it's for commercial and industrial loans, your garden variety business loans. And I think the useful thing before you look at the most recent data is up here on the left, 1990. 1990 was a recession year, and banks tightened their credit standards. Then we recovered from the recession. We had some good years in the early 90s, and then we had a recession in 2001, lasting into 2002. Banks tightened their credit. And then they loosened again, and then they tightened in the last year. It's an old saw in the banking industry. Banks never make bad loans in bad times. They make all their bad loans in good times. And after they've made bad loans in good times and they realize, oh, heck, we have made bad loans, they tighten up their credit. But that is kind of a normal process. And in the average recession, we don't call it a credit crunch. It's just kind of what always happens. But we had a couple of things happen that are a little bit different this time. First, banks found that they had liquidity problems. Liquidity. One of the things that goes on behind the scenes in a bank that you never see as a customer is bankers wondering, what the heck will I do if customers start withdrawing money? Like they start pulling out their deposits. They get nervous about us. Washington Mutual had this problem in spades. So they do some exercises, some planning exercises, contingency planning. And one of the things they say is, well, gee, maybe we have some securities we can sell. So they've made loans, but they've also invested in treasury bills or mortgage-backed securities. And mortgage-backed securities had been very liquid. Liquid in the sense that if I as a bank had $100 million worth of mortgage-backed securities and I wanted to convert them into cash, I called Wall Street and I got my cash in 15 minutes' time. I mean, it was that good a market. Well, suddenly, you know what's happening with the market for mortgage-backed securities. It's not a source of liquidity. We also had banks using one another as sources of liquidity. So if your bank needs $10 million and they don't have it one Tuesday afternoon, they just call another bank and they lend to each other. And usually they lend to each other at the same interest rate as treasury bills, sort of the risk-free rate, plus a quarter of a percent, just because a bank is a little riskier than the U.S. government. Treasury bill rates plus a quarter. Well, that spread got up to treasury bills plus 4 percentage points. So the banks were looking at each other saying, I don't trust you. I don't trust you. And they got very nervous. So what do you do if you're a banker and you think, well, gee, if people start pulling their money out, I don't have securities to sell like I used to have, and I may not be able to borrow from other banks. The bank needs to build up its liquidity. How does it do that? It stops making loans, stops making new loans. So that was one worry. Then we had an additional worry. So the first worry is just bank attitudes. The second worry is liquidity. The third one is capital. So the bank has to have some skin in the game. It has to have some equity, some owner's investment, and they lost some of that by having loans that went south. And they had loans to real estate developers, plus some of those mortgage-backed securities lose value. And as they lost value, boom, the bank has less net worth. And the net worth is a ratio, net worth divided by assets. And if your net worth goes down, your assets have to go down if you're going to conform to the regulatory requirements. So banks cut back on their lending because of that reason. Well, now we have government response. It is, for those of you interested in policy, not what I would have done if I'd been given a blank sheet of paper and unlimited power. But It is a policy that has gotten more capital into the banking system. They've helped a little bit with the liquidity, and I think we're going to work through this. I think, keeping my fingers crossed, the way I think about it is, you know, if you're sick, you might run a temperature of like 102. And that's kind of normal bad. Well, at the height of the credit crunch, we got up to a fever in the credit markets of like 105, 106, a life-threatening level of fever. And we're still up there. Maybe we're at 104 and a half. But we're now looking towards getting to a normal bad fever, a normal 102. It's bad, but it's not really, really life-threatening. And I think we're going to go from that life-threatening to merely bad, based upon the TARP and the capital infusions into the banking system. So in terms of a timeline, when are things going to get better? We are going to see, I think, better credit environment over the next few months, 2 or 3 months probably. Now, what does this mean for contents if you're planning a meeting? Access to credit is important for all businesses. All businesses. Now, not all businesses borrow. There are some corporations, Microsoft is a good example, a lot of cash on the balance sheet, they don't borrow, but you know, their customers borrow. Got a lot of small business customers. So any industry group that you're thinking about, they're dependent on credit. Any other cross-section of business that includes a variety of companies, they're dependent on credit. You have small, very small businesses running their business off of a credit card. Well, credit card access has tightened up. Small business loans, equipment leasing, all of this has tightened up. So this, when I think about what's different in business environment in 2009, this is the biggest difference. And if you're serving people in the business community, I think you probably could have gone 5 or 10 years without doing a session on access to credit. This is the time to do it because it is a huge subject. Now, I've been talking about business. Let me also mention state and local governments. State and local governments are paying higher interest rates now. If you're an investor in a high tax bracket, great time to buy muni bonds. But if you are looking for your local county, your local city, to issue some bonds to get some road work going, it's a tight time. Now, the bigger cities, the big healthy cities, Dallas, Atlanta, I'm sure, they can still access the bond market. The folks who are having a lot of trouble are small cities, rural counties, and special districts, the Lake Oswego Mosquito Abatement District. And the problem is these guys don't have their own credit rating. If you're a major city, a large county, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, they have an idea of how creditworthy you are. They'll rate your bonds. But if you're a little guy, what happens is you don't have your own credit rating. You rely on a third-party guarantee. And AmBac is one company that does that, and it's an insurance company with a AAA rating. And so the small borrower pays a fee to the big guy and says, hey, you guarantee my bonds. And then the bond buyers say, well, gee, they're guaranteed. The second biggest player in this field after AmBac was a company called AIG. You've heard of AIG? So the value of those third-party guarantees has just gone down the toilet, which means that smaller cities, counties, and special districts are going to have a lot of trouble. So if you're serving the small government market, this is an important topic. Or if you're serving people who are like contractors to state and local government, I think this is an important topic. And it is actionable. It is actionable. There are steps that borrowers can take today to prepare for a tight credit market. I highly recommend we get that on the agenda very often. I am about to talk about the third issue, but we're a small enough group we could take some breaks and do some questions if you have questions. What is about to come is a discussion of consumer confidence and my actual forecast. But if you have a question on the housing issue or credit crunch, yeah, sir.
Something where they rescue the mortgages to help expedite some of these sales? Is that something that you're talking about?
Yeah, the question is, are they going to rescue mortgages? The government is talking about that in a lot of different directions. They haven't found anything that works real well. Plan A out of the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was let's just change the terms a little bit. People have mortgages that they're just never going to be able to pay. Let's change the terms. What we have found is that half of them that get new terms, the borrowers cannot meet the payments in the first 6 months. Well, you know, if you can't meet the payments in the first 6 months, the politicians would really like to do something. They don't understand, many of them, what I'm saying, that you can't solve the housing problem, but they would like to do something. They'd like to prevent foreclosures, but there's no good solution. If there were something that would really work, I think there'd be a consensus in Congress to do something quickly, but we don't have much that would work there. Yeah, I think the banking, the question is, will this solve the banking crisis, the TARP? TARP is part of it. The Federal Reserve putting a lot of stimulus into the system is going to encourage them. One other point, and I come from the banking industry, I kind of think like a banker, is right now, if you make a deposit at a bank, they're probably not lending it out. They say, oh yeah, we lend to the community. Well, they're not doing much lending right now. So they're investing it at 0.15% in treasury bills, or what we call Fed funds. That's bank-to-bank lending. 0.15%, which gives them, if you deposit $10,000, it gives them $15 of interest in a year's time. But they've got to pay an insurance premium for their FDIC insurance. That leaves them with $3 net. They cannot mail you a statement every month for $3 a year. So if you open up a bank account with $10,000, $10,000 ought to be real profitable to the banks. Today it is not. But if they would start making loans, if they would find, you know, good borrowers, then they can start collecting 6-8%, and everything looks good. But they just have to be willing to stomach a little bit of risk. Any other questions before we move on? So we've got two problems in the economy. We've got the housing problem, another year to solve. We've got the credit crunch, which I think is going to come through fairly quickly. Let's talk about consumers. Now, you folks are not just meeting planners and in the hotel industry. You're also consumers yourself. And I got to tell you, you got a bad attitude. Your attitudes really suck. This is a measure of one of the measures of consumer confidence, and it just goes down, down, down. Incidentally, we have other measures of consumer confidence. They're based upon a telephone survey asking questions like, gee, is this a good time to look for work? Well, not only is that obvious, but as a guy who's had a job and then works for myself, I think it's never a good time to look for work, but that's my personal bias. Is it a good time to look for work? Are you planning on buying a car or major appliance in the next 6 months? Questions not only about attitudes, but about actual spending or personal financial plans. And they roll this together into this index. And there are two different major ones. They look the same. There's also an index of corporate executives. So if you're thinking about business spending, what do corporate executives think? It looks almost exactly like this. And there's another survey of small business owners done by the National Federation of Independent Business. It looks just like this. One chart, every survey looks exactly like this, just bad attitudes. Well, how do we get out of this? Consumer spending, as you know, is about two-thirds of the economy, and we are now in a big kickback where consumers are dialing back. Let's take a picture of just how much they've cut back. That's ugly enough. Any news there? Any surprise? This is the way I like to look at it. These blue columns show on a percentage change basis what happened to after-tax income, disposable income, in the last 4 months. So September, a little bit of an increase. Zero change in October, small decreases in November and December. And then the pink columns showed what consumers actually did in terms of their spending. They have been cutting back their spending dramatically, and disproportionately to the cutback in their income. Now, we understand somebody who's lost his job or her job having to cut back. But what we have is people who have not lost their jobs cutting back. So I'm getting my hair cut the other day. I go to the cheap barber, as you can tell, I'm sure. And, so my barber and I are talking about the economy. And I said, well, how's business? The nice thing about being an economist is I can go anywhere, say, how's business, and it becomes tax deductible. There's a follow-on joke that I can't share with you, really. No, you've got a bad mind. Where was I? So the barber says, well, his business is up. Why is his business up? Because one of the barbers in the shop had an accident. He's going to be out of work for 6 weeks. So the other barbers are sort of carrying on. So the guy who's cutting my hair says his income is up. His wife works for a bank. They're a little bit nervous. Maybe she could lose her job. But he has more income now than a year ago, and he is cutting back everything discretionary. Absolutely everything discretionary. Now, there are some people who have lost their jobs. There are other people who have good reason to worry about losing their jobs. But then, my dentist is not going to lose her job. My mailman's not going to lose his job. There are a lot of people who are safe. I went through the industry detail from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and looking at the categories of industries, there are 47 million people who work in industries that have more employment now than they had a year ago. So you hear about all these cutbacks. Yeah, they're happening in construction. They're happening in manufacturing. But there are some industry sectors that are actually growing, and we have 47 million people in those. So if you are in one of those situations, you are cutting back even though you don't really have to. And this is planting the seeds for the expansion, the ultimate recovery. Recessions never go on forever, and it's hard to get out of this doom and gloom, but I'm about to tell you how we're going to get out of it. But let me just emphasize how hard it is to get your head outside of where you are right now. In Portland, we had snow on the ground for 2 weeks. We get snow 2 or 3 days a year. It comes, it goes, and we had it, and it stayed on and on. And on 2 weeks, couldn't get down the hill because the police closed one street, and one of our neighbors managed to close the other one himself by sliding his SUV in an awkward situation. We are stuck. We are cold. We are unhappy. The power's gone out every day or two for a little while. We don't know how long. Have you ever been in that kind of situation? You're just there. And if somebody had said to me, Bill, what's the temperature in this neighborhood going to be come August? I would have said 35, 37 degrees. I mean, it's just hard to get yourself. Or have you ever in the winter packed for a vacation down in Cancun or Hawaii or someplace like that? Can you really avoid throwing in 3 sweaters and some long underwear? You know all you need is a t-shirt and shorts, but it's just hard to get out of it. And today, it is hard to get out of the doom and gloom mode. But let me tell you what's going to happen here. These people who have cut back on their spending, they are saving. They are spending less than they earn, and money is accumulating in their bank book. They are paying down credit cards, and they are going to find in a few months they have money left over. We have unemployment. I think the number from Friday was 7.6%. The common number for us forecasters is a little over 9. Maybe it's 9%. Maybe it's 9.5. I'll even say maybe unemployment gets up to 10%. But do the arithmetic. 10% unemployment is 90% employment. So if you're one of the 90% who are employed, come May, say, you have dodged a bullet. You've still got a job, and you have been saving because you were scared. Now you've got money. What happens with money in your pocket? My experience is it burns a hole. And now that's not just that, I need a new boat or I need new stuff, guy stuff, or that, I decide that out of guilt that I bought a new sail for my boat, I encourage my wife to buy some new shoes. It's not just that. There are strong econometric relationships that say, hey, when people have more money, they do more spending. Now, I hear folks say, gee, but this is a different experience. We're never going to be like we were back in 2005. You know, we thought things were perfect. The world was always going to be wonderful. And we spent. And I will concede that we're not going to go back to that level. That is not going to be quite like it used to be. But this is not going to be like our grandparents. You know, grandparents lived through the Great Depression. They were permanently changed. This is not a permanently changing experience. So not only do I have the econometric equations behind me, but I've got a little bit of psychology. Now, I've got to give you a caution. You're going to hear a psychological statement from an economics major. But think of the people that you've known for 20 years. Family, friends, business colleagues. And think, are they not the same people that they were 20 years ago? You know, maybe we're grayer, maybe we've got a little bit more weight, but people are fundamentally the same. The guys who are into the gadgets, the ladies who are into the shoes, they're still pretty much the same people. And I think that we may dial it down, we may be a little bit more conservative on average, but we are going to get back. And those folks, those poor folks who still don't have big screen TVs, this is going to be a great opportunity, having saved, to get that. So my forecast is we're going to come out of it in terms of consumer spending in this spring. Now, earlier somebody was saying, hey, do you have good news for us? And I had to say, good news is on back order, should be available in April or May. Let's talk about what the attitudinal thing means here in terms of program content. Attitudes are critical to everybody, especially businesses. If you're selling to consumers, obviously consumer confidence is important. If you're selling to other businesses, B2B, then you have to face the fact that at sometimes business executives, small business owners are very gloomy. They don't want to spend money needlessly, and they're going to be very slow to do anything discretionary. Nonprofits, for those of you involved in nonprofits, donors who are nervous about what their net worth is it going up, is it going down, their attitudes are very, very significant here. And government, sometimes people have to have an attitude of optimism about the future to feel comfortable about voting for tax bases. And those of you who are actually from the, say, hotel and convention industry, you know that attitudes are very important. Discretionary consumer spending is important, and businesses' attitudes about, hey, should we send our people on the road? Should we have a meeting? All very sensitive. So this would be a good area for content, I think, in a lot of meetings. So we have talked about the three major problems in the economy, when they're going to get through, and let me tell you where my forecast takes us. The dark blue lines are history. They're actually in the records. The light blue is my forecast. And that first quarter, the current quarter, is really, really lousy. I think it is dismal. Now, you can go online to the MPI site and download handouts that I've prepared. They aren't going to look exactly like this because they were prepared a couple of weeks ago. So you can either download them and just remember that a couple of weeks ago, things weren't quite so grim in this first quarter, but they were worse in the fourth quarter. No big deal. The other alternative is I'll give you my email address in a moment, and if you'd like to see a copy of this, I'd be more than happy to send you a copy of these slides. So the economy gets better. This is our low point in the current quarter, and then the first positive bar, this is a growth rate for GDP. We are growing in the second quarter, the April, May, June quarter, according to my forecast. Now, I've got to share with you something that's, I'm a little bit nervous mentioning it, but sometimes we in the economics profession do not do a perfect job of forecasting. I hate to sort of show our dirty laundry, but every now and then we get something a little bit wrong. And I'll tell you, I am not absolutely convinced that the second quarter of this year is a growth quarter. If it's not a growth quarter, it's maybe plus 1%, 0, or minus 1%. Somewhere it's a transitional quarter, a little up or a little down. Where I have a lot of confidence, though, is that later on, the second half of this year, we're getting growth going. And the biggest factor of the things I've talked about is the turnaround in consumer spending, and that happens fairly quickly. Something I haven't talked about is monetary stimulus from the Federal Reserve. I'm going to hold off on that for a moment, but it is a big force here. This sounds optimistic to a lot of people. Let me tell you the way in which it is pessimistic. The negative is so negative that you got to ask yourself, how long is it until those positive quarters make up for the negative quarters? And it ends up being spring of 2010 before we have caught up all ground. And you'll be reading the newspapers, listening to television, and let me help you translate economists speaking into everyday language. You're walking down the street. And you're not paying attention because you're thinking about one of the great MPI sessions you just came from. And because you're not paying attention, you fall into a 10-foot hole. I, as an economist, see you fall. I do not chuckle because I'm a social scientist just observing things. Maybe I laugh a little bit. But I see you fall into the hole. And as you're falling, I say, that lady is in recession. Recession is going down. And then she's at the bottom. She picks herself up. She takes one step up at the bottom of a 10-foot hole, takes first step up, and as the economist, I say, she's in recovery. She has stopped going down. She's in recovery. Now, the fact of the matter is she's 9 feet down a 10-foot hole. It doesn't feel to her like she has recovered, but because she stopped going down, she started turning up. So as an economist, I'm going to say next quarter, gee, the economy's in recovery, and most of the people I talk to are going to say, you are a blithering idiot. Because it's not going to feel like a recovery until we make up for all the lost ground. So it will feel like a recovery in about a year and 3 months from now. It normally takes less time to feel like we've recovered. Normally, we get a sharp increase in economic performance in the early stages of a recovery. We make up for lost ground normally. So don't think I'm too optimistic. If I were just sort of superimposing a normal recovery on where we've been, I would have some columns way up 5%, maybe 6%. But I don't do that because what really gets the economy going in a normal recovery is residential construction, housing industry, low mortgage rates. A lot of people take advantage of it, and we're so overbuilt, that's not going to happen. So that's the economic forecast. And for those of you in the who are not meeting planners but in the hotel industry, I think that you'll see a lot of simultaneity, that the interest in people visiting your hotels hits bottom and then turns up this spring, and that's both consumers and it's short lead time business. Short lead time corporate business. The problem is the long lead time kind of work. And let me just sort of roll through some of, I'm doing a presentation for my fellow members of the National Speakers Association on this. Let me just flow through for those of you from the industry. Associations and some corporations, but let's talk associations, tend to be lagging indicators. And that is not a pejorative. It means that they change their spending behavior after the economy changes. So you're the executive director of the Porta Potty Association. You're going right along. Everything looks fine. Your members start having trouble. You may not know yet your members are having trouble. They may have decided, gee, times are tough. We're not going to renew our membership at the next annual renewal cycle. You may not know that until 6 months go by and all of a sudden, boom, you send out these renewals and nobody paid. Or you may think everything is going just fine and then there are decisions being made for the people who exhibit at your trade show not to show up. Only you don't know it until the deadline when they have to put a deposit on. So as a result, there's kind of a lag. The best association executives really keep their pulse on their members, understand what's going on with their members, but they have to get beyond the board of directors because the board is really, really into the association, dedicated to the association. The executive directors need to understand those folks who are on the edge. Maybe they stay with the association, maybe they drop their membership, and it requires staying in touch with the membership. Corporations, some corporations have short lead time stuff. That's like a one person going off on a sales call, but the big meeting activities tend to be longer lead time. Anything you can do to help shorten that lead time in the turnaround makes sense. So in the early stages of the turnaround, you'll have people who are thinking, oh, I think we're ready for a meeting, but they haven't done 18 months of lead time because things have been wild and freaky. And I think the folks who will serve them the best are the people who are very, very flexible about, oh, yeah, I know it's shorter lead time than normal, but we can make it happen. Let's talk about monetary policy. I love monetary policy. That's what we economists talk about, the Federal Reserve doing things. And, oh, this is the content clues. I got ahead of myself. So you're thinking about, what do I want to do at a meeting? Contingency planning for the recovery. I didn't forecast this recession, I'm embarrassed to say. But I'll tell you what I'm proud of. 2 years ago, I started telling business, actually 2.5 years ago, I started telling business leaders, my clients, do some contingency planning for the possibility of a recession. At that time, I said, it's 1 chance out of 4, 1 chance out of 5 we'll have a recession, but you ought to do some contingency planning. Today, in this mood of doom and gloom, I think one of the most useful things that we can suggest to people, whether they're leaders of business, nonprofits, or government, is do some contingency planning for the recovery. And when I talk to business guys, they say, oh, yeah, I'm ready for the recovery, bring it on. But it turns out they may not have the key personnel, may have laid off some of the people that they need to sell, to produce, to deliver. They may not have the equipment in place. They may not have the financing in place. And so I recommend a 4-step process for contingency planning. I'll just sort of roll through it quickly. The first is figure out your own vulnerability to changes in the economy. Some companies are not very vulnerable. Healthcare is a good example. Some companies are very vulnerable, especially manufacturing and construction. So I suggest forget this GDP stuff that we economists like to talk about and narrow down to your own vulnerability. Second step in the process is to figure out an early warning system specific to your own industry. So again, it's don't listen to Connerly talking about GDP. Find somebody who can actually dial in to, so if you're selling glass bottles to the beer industry, you really want to understand what consumers are doing with discretionary spending, because for many people, beer is a discretionary expense. For me, it's a necessity, but for other folks, it's a discretionary expense. So the glass bottle guy really has to understand the ultimate user. And I suggest to people an early warning system that helps them understand the early warning. The third step in this contingency planning process is the actual contingency plan. Take a blank piece of paper and say, hey, if things change, you can do this for a change for the better or a change for the worse. If things change, what am I going to want to do? And you might sketch out a series of steps. In the downtime, it might be the hiring freeze followed by some layoffs on the labor side, and you sort through labor policy, capital spending policy, collecting receivables, a whole host of things. I've got a checklist in my book if you're interested. On the upside, it's like, do I have the right people? Am I going to have to hire another maintenance electrician? Do I have my financing in place, and so forth? Then the fourth step, after you have a list of things that you may do, is to actually manage the business to maintain flexibility. And it's easiest to understand this with a family example. Radio interviewer was saying, hey, Bill, can a family do this economic contingency planning? And I said, yeah. And I said, one of the steps on the contingency plan for, hey, what happens if one of the breadwinners in our family gets laid off? What do we do? And as you tick through the possible action items you might make, one of them could very well be switch to a cheaper cell phone plan. Maybe change vendors, maybe pull the phone away from one of the kids, or, you know, do something there. But step 4 in the economic contingency process is maintaining flexibility. So I got a call from Verizon, my cell phone company, recently saying, hey, Bill, it's been more than 2 years since you got that phone, that cheap-ass phone, probably worn out now. Why don't you get a new phone for free? All you have to do is commit to a 2-year plan. Well, if I commit to a 2-year plan, I've lost my flexibility. I can't go changing carriers, can't go cutting back too much. So businesses, government agencies, nonprofits, maintain flexibility, and you do that through things like, are you hiring people or contracting out? Are you leasing extra space for expansion or not? There's a whole host of decisions. So contingency planning, and especially now for the recovery, with all this doom and gloom, helping the people who fill your meetings understand what they will need to do to get ready for the recovery, I think is very, very valuable. And this suggestion applies to all organizations that are sensitive to the recovery. There are a few that aren't, and I mentioned like healthcare. Let me talk especially about sales reps, because that's a very common area for corporate meetings, get the salespeople together. The biggest swings in market share occur at turning points. Let me repeat that. The biggest swings in market share occur at turning points. So a few years ago, I'm doing a little work for a magazine publisher, and they had, I think, 7 sales reps. And they had cut back to 3, and one of those 3 was part-time, so like 2.5 sales reps. Well, those salespeople were not going out making sales calls anymore. They were just answering the incoming placements, orders. When they did have a little extra time, were they making outgoing sales calls? No. Why not? They were discouraged. They hadn't had any success with an outgoing sales call for months and months. And, you know, you get turned down enough, some people stop asking. Well, in this environment where the salespeople are just discouraged, somewhere else, there's a young buck salesperson who maybe is too stupid to know that we're in a recession. And this person just keeps making sales calls and sales calls and sales calls, trying to perfect the sales call and not getting anywhere, but, you know, young on the job. And when the economy does turn around, who's going to get the business? You know who's going to get the business. That's right. So this is a time to be thinking and encouraging, I think, your organizations, keep the salespeople energized. So that would be a key content clue, I think. All right. Now let's talk about monetary policy. We're going to finish up this stuff on the economy, start doing some questions. The Federal Reserve stimulates the economy by pushing money into the banking system. And when they do that, we get low interest rates. Now, some people think it's the low interest rates themselves that are stimulative. Other people think it's the growth of the money supply that's stimulative. And this is like a religious battle within the economics profession. So it's sort of like Jews versus Muslims, and it's playing out in the American Economic Review and the Journal of Political Economy. And you don't need to know too much about it. But the Federal Reserve has, in fact, by anybody's calculation, put a lot of stimulus into the system. Now, in normal times, this stimulus would be inflationary. But these are not normal times. I don't have to repeat that, I'm sure. The stimulus that the Federal Reserve is putting in is not translating into quite the growth of the money supply as normal, and that increased money supply in the economy is not translating into more consumer spending. So right now, we're not getting inflation. However, when we get to normal times, it will be inflationary. We've got a lot of stimulus in the pipeline, and we cannot let it hit the economy when the economy recovers, or we'll have inflation. So I am forecasting that the Federal Reserve pushes interest rates up. The blue line here is the federal funds rate, the rate that the Federal Reserve really impacts, and I think we're going to get a big swing up in interest rates. That is, I think, I'm fairly confident of that, but somebody I have a lot of respect for kind of shares my framework but says, Bill, they won't do it. Instead, they'll let us get some inflation. So let me say a few words about inflation. What we have, we've gone through a major swing, and those of you who, well, you're all in the meetings industry, you know that we had gas prices go way high, we had airline costs go up because of the fuel prices, and then we saw world oil prices go from 140 down to 40, and it's like, gee, are we going to go back to having face-to-face meetings? Is that going to feel cheap? I mean, I celebrate that I can buy gas for less than $2 a gallon. Who would have thought we'd be celebrating that kind of stuff? I think that we're going to keep prices low, but I also think that this period we had with high energy prices kind of opens us up. more people are thinking about the hybrids, more people thinking about webinars. Think of a webinar as the meeting version of a Prius. So I think that there's going to be an undertone of, gee, are there ways to avoid the high fuel costs, even when fuel costs are low? So I would suggest that you consider some possibilities for that. But back on interest rates, I think that there's going to be a big swing in interest rates, both long-term and short-term. And for content clues, this is very important if you're working for a financial institution or highly leveraged companies. Highly leveraged is our jargon for a lot of borrowing. Some businesses don't do too much borrowing, and if they don't do too much borrowing, you can probably skip this topic. But some companies borrow a lot, and if you are working for a company or an industry where there's a lot of borrowing, you may want to do some kind of content related to the change in interest rates and help your folks do some contingency planning. Now, let me help you with some sector-by-sector stuff, and you can maybe find out where you fit here. This is like, who are the ultimate buyers? And we don't include intermediate, one company taking in another company's laundry here. Consumer spending, I think, is 2009 is going to look grim, but this is sort of the year 2009 compared to the year 2008, and I think we hit the low point in the spring, and then the second half of the year looks much better. Business capital spending was strong, and that's like companies investing in machinery, computers, software, and that is going to look lousy in 2009. Business capital spending normally lags. Like, corporate treasurers want to see the economy actually stronger. We'll see residential construction down. Exports will grow, but not by as much. Government swings around a little bit. The federal government, fairly stable. Now, we have a big stimulus package. Let me talk about that. The stimulus package, believe it or not, is not critical to my economic forecast. I think it will have relatively little impact in the short run because so much of it happens later. And when we finally get the fiscal impact of the stimulus program, we'll also be cutting defense spending in my forecast. And, you know, we have been ramping up defense spending. Even if we just level it down, that means that we're not having the growth that we're used to. So I don't have a big impact in my economic forecast from the stimulus program. But it means that there are a number of, I think, programmatic implications here. So state and local governments will have tight budgets for a while, except in the capital spending, the public works, where we're getting federal stimulus. Let's talk about the content implications there, and this is a little bit more detail on where we're going here. The first sector to recover, and this is just months away, I think, is consumer discretionary spending. In the middle will be exports, and then the later sectors, housing, business capital spending, state and local government. And the reason I put this up here is because if you're like setting up a meeting for one company, you maybe have different topics you want to talk about than another company. So if you're dealing with the auto industry, I would want to be ready to talk about a recovery. If you're dealing with the home builders, it's a little too early to talk about recovery. Tell them that if they want to talk about recovery, they got to watch their cholesterol and get plenty of exercise, and it's going to be a while. Don't look at your watch. Don't even look at a 2009 calendar. You need one of those five-year calendars. So that's the big picture. The economy is going to recover. Recessions always end. Now, what I want to do is take some questions, and then I'll close in a few minutes with a little bit of a story. But remember, the recession is going to end. It always does. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. What's the threshold that separates a recession from a depression? We don't have one. And, you know, we think of the Great Depression, and it just went on and on. We had a little bit of a recovery, but we had the depressions we've had, 1873 was another one, are just way out of the league that we're in. And even the most pessimistic people, they may use the jargon of depression, but when you actually look at their numbers, it's not coming anywhere close to the 1930s. Does that help? Yes. Oh, yeah. How does the stock market figure into this? Or are you asking me if you'll ever be able to retire? Both. The stock market is mostly a resultant of what's going on in the economy, but it sometimes is a little bit of an influence itself. So there's a little bit of mutual causation, but usually the stock market is driven by the economy. And the economy is weak. Everybody knows it. The stock prices have come down. But we also had an unusual attitude towards risk. And this is global. You know, I've been talking about a lot about the United States, but you could take what I said, and it applies to most of the countries. And the best way to think about it was go back to the spring of 2007, almost 2 years ago, but not quite. Global financial markets didn't care about risk. If you said, hey, I've got two options for you. One is perfectly safe. The other is like really, really, really risky, but pays 0.25% more. Markets would have said, I don't care about it being risky. I want that extra 0.25%. Junk bonds, bonds that are not investment grade, they paid 3 percentage points more than a U.S. government bond. 3 percentage points more. That spread right now is like 15 percentage points more. So we were at an abnormal position in early 2007 where people just thought everything was going to be perfect for the rest of our lives. And now they think everything is going to be absolutely lousy for the rest of our lives. And I think we're going to find a middle course. My own forecast, well, before I get to my own forecast, let me talk about the historical regularities about the stock market. On average, the stock market turns up before the economy. Now, that is an average that has a wide distribution. I mean, sometimes it's 3 months, I think the average is like 3 to 5 months before the economy turns up, the stock market turns up. But sometimes it's 12 months early, sometimes it's 6 months late. So it's just a little bit too iffy to rely on. But on average, the stock market turns up first. And I think that if you buy stock today, in 2019, I think you'll be happy. Now, there may be, you may not be happy at the end of 2009, but give it 10 years, and I think we're going to see that this was a good time for the stock market. Yes, sir. Yeah. What are the consequences of all this debt that the Treasury is borrowing? The consequences of the debt in the long run are negative, without a doubt. It is, you know, we don't magically create something out of nothing. We have stimulus, but at what cost? The cost is, in the future, we're going to be paying interest on the bonds. That's going to be a weight on the economy. The economy will grow slower. But it is not a short-term problem. If it were a short-term problem, there'd be a couple of indicators. The first indicator we would see is if the U.S. Treasury has to pay a higher interest rate. So let's say that you're not managing your credit cards very well. One of the first indicators is Capital One says, gee, this 9% interest rate you've been at, it's now 23. That, and if that happens to you, that's a sign that you got a problem. What's happened with the U.S. Treasury is their interest rates have gone down. The world is saying we want safe investments and we don't need much of an interest rate. And what is surprising is that all around the world people are trying to buy U.S. Treasury bills and Treasury bonds. We think our government's doing is kind of weird. We're nervous about our country, but the rest of the world says, hey, we want to be there. Related to that is the second thing you'd see if you are borrowing too much and we're going to have a short-term problem, not only higher interest rates, but you'd see your exchange rate going down. And countries that have a currency crisis have their exchange rate going down. Ours has gone up in the last year because people around the world say, oh, I want to be in dollars. It's the safest economy there. So long-term, we got a problem, but it's not something, you know, on the list of things that I worry about in 2009 and 2010, having borrowed too much is not on that list, but it gets on the list in a few years. Another question? Well, let me tell you a little story. Let me emphasize, though, I'd be more than happy to receive an email from you with the questions that you're embarrassed to ask in public. That's funny. Isn't that funny? the questions you're embarrassed to ask him. Thank you. With the questions you're embarrassed to ask in public, I'm going to hang around after this, be happy to talk to you. But first, I want to tell, and I'm happy to email these slides if you'd like, but I want to tell you about a lunch I went to. It was 1988. I was a bank economist, and one of our loan officers said, Bill, go to lunch with a client. And I just love factory tours, so I said, sure. And I met this entrepreneur who was really, really, really good. I mean, he was really good. And he had a focus on customer service that really was exceptional. He had built a team of people really into customer service. He had a unique way of bundling some goods and services to better serve his customers. And his customers were happy. He was very profitable at the same time. He had two facilities. He wanted to double in size, add two more facilities. And our bank wanted to lend the money to help him expand. Everything was perfect except he had read an awful book. The book was The Great Depression of 1990. And again, this lunch is happening in 1988. The Great Depression of 1990 was a New York Times bestseller. And the author of this book said, we are about to hit a depression worse than the 1930s, a depression that will last 7 years. Corporations will fail. They won't be able to pay their debt. The stock market will be really, really bad. Banks will fail. So many banks will fail, the author said, that the FDIC will have to stop insuring deposits. And the author recommended that the people who read the book close their bank accounts and just hold currency. The doom and gloom book to beat all doom and gloom books. Well, I spent all lunch trying to talk this talented entrepreneur out of believing this book, but I failed. And in the end, he read the book. He decided he was not going to expand his business. I go by his place of business a couple of times a year. It is still there. But what I see is the market for his goods and services has tripled since 1988. He got none of the growth. Other people came in because there was a void. Other people came in, took the market share that should have been his, copied his methods, and they made millions of dollars that should have been his, but they weren't his because he had bet against America. The American economy is resilient and strong. The American people are resilient and strong. The American nation is resilient and strong. And of all the economic lessons I can share with you, that's the best one for 2009. Thank you.